You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
But sadly, the arrow of time only points in one direction.
Or maybe the arrow of time points in two directions.
You're determined to argue with everything I say today, aren't you? Where have you got this notion from?
From physicist Julian Barber of Oxford University, who has a new paper in Physical Review Letters explaining the origin of time's arrow. Just why time marches in one direction has troubled physicists because the underlying microscopic laws of physics are symmetric. But in new work, Barber and colleagues have carried out an analysis that suggests that at the Big Bang, two mirror universes were created, with arrows of time pointing in opposite directions, preserving symmetry. I recently met up with Barber and one of his co-authors, Flavio McCarty, while they were attending a meeting at Imperial College London. They told me about their new research, how it led them to identify a gravitational arrow of time, and how all this reminds them of Roman mythology.
So it was suddenly like the Roman god Janus, who looks in two ways at once. There is a central point, and in both directions, it looks the same. If you say time is moving in the direction in which structure is growing, then on either side of this Janus point, the middle of the two heads of Janus, you will say time is pointing in opposite directions and time is growing. That's the direction in which time is increasing. And really everything we've been doing has followed from this realization.
In Roman mythology, Janus is the god of beginnings and transitions and is famously depicted with two faces, joined at the back of the head and facing out in opposite directions. Presenting his latest research at a conference at Imperial College London in September, Oxford physicist Julian Barber, whom we just heard, used an image of the two-faced god to illustrate his new theory of the gravitational origin of the arrow of time. In his view, the Big Bang created two universes with two arrows of time pointing, like Janus's faces, in opposite directions. The arrow of time has long perplexed physicists because it forces us to march in only one direction, from the past to the future. Yet the equations that underlie physics at the microscopic level are time symmetric. That is, reactions and processes could just as easily have occurred forwards or backwards. So how is time's arrow imposed on the universe while this underlying symmetry is suppressed? I caught up with Barber and one of his co-authors, Flavio McCarty of the Perimeter Institute, during a busy and noisy lunch break in the meeting at London's Victorian Albert Museum. Barber told me more about their new paper, written with Perimeter's Tim Kozlovsky. The team theoretically analysed the motion of particles in the universe and how they clump together to create structure, and then reversed time to see how that behaviour was affected, leading them to their surprising discovery.
The paper that came out yesterday in Physical Review Letters is just about this idea of thinking about the arrow of time being defined by gravitational creation of structure. It goes back to a long-standing interest. I've been interested in the question of the arrow of time as long as I can remember. So it's always been at the back of my mind. And the paper most recently came out of, actually Flavio and I decided we needed to make a grant application 2.5 years ago. And in making that grant application, just one idea occurred to me, which has really been key to all of the later developments, was, you see, the basic laws of Newton and Einstein are time reversal symmetric. They don't distinguish between the direction of time. And normally, particularly when you think about a gravitational system, they start with, shall we say, a fairly uniform distribution of particles in gravity, a fairly uniform state, and then they notice that the uniformity disappears, it tends to clump. This is called the Jeans instability, and it leads to what people call anti-thermodynamic behavior of gravity. It has negative specific heat. If you take energy out of an ordinary system, its temperature goes down. If you take energy out of a self-gravitating system, its energy goes up. The thing that finally occurred to me, I mean, I'd been very close to this idea for a long time, but it was in talking to Flavio about things, But in the process, it led me to say, well, what happens if instead of just following the instability as it gets hotter and hotter, we reverse the arrow, the direction in which all the particles are going, and seeing what happens? Well, what we've realized is that then, as you go in the opposite time direction, the system gets even more uniform, and then it passes through a very special point, and as it comes out the other side, it also goes into this situation where it's getting hotter, and it's symmetric on the other side.
So let me ask you, is this a mathematical result, or is it something that you're saying physically happens, that if you have a big bang, you know, we might find ourselves in one universe where we think time is going forward, but at the same time, another universe must be created to kind of balance out the symmetry. Is that just something that's a mathematical result, or does this actually happen?
The key thing is to take the law seriously and say the law is correct. And then it's just, at least in the Newtonian theory, it's an inescapable consequence of the law. It's a delight for us. Nobody seems to have thought of this before, and we stumbled on it by accident, you know. It's nothing like having to write a grant proposal.
Barber's picture of a double-faced Big Bang, creating two universes with two time arrows, reinstates the underlying time symmetry. The Big Bang, rather than being the initial point of the universe, is the midpoint, or Janus point, as Barber calls it, between twin universes which share one past but have two futures. This discovery led the team to make a startling claim about the relationship between time's arrow and entropy, a measure of the disorder of the universe. Physicists usually say that time marches in the direction in which entropy, or disorder, increases. This has often led them to puzzle over the mystery of why the universe began with low entropy in the first place. Barber, however, claims that the opposite is true, and that the Janus point, the point of the Big Bang, represents maximum entropy, and then in both the universes that are created, time tracks the direction in which entropy decreases.
People think, and have thought for a long time, that the universe must have started with an extremely low entropy. This is called the past hypothesis. Past hypothesis is from David Albert, the philosopher of science. And people have been very influenced by Roger Penrose's idea that the gravitational entropy must have been very low, although we know that the matter was in thermal equilibrium at the Big Bang. Now, if our ideas are right, and there's still an if, this is certainly right in Newtonian theory, and because Newtonian theory has many structural features in common with Einstein's gravity, we are hopeful that it will go through there. In fact, it turns out to be quite the opposite. Actually, the entropy is maximal at the Big Bang of the universe, and it's been going down ever since. But you have to distinguish between the entropy of the whole universe and the entropy of subsystems within it.
So I have to ask you a little bit more about this idea of kind of turning entropy on its head and the way that we usually talk about the progression of time. And you're sort of saying, well, we start off at the Big Bang with maximum entropy and we're moving towards low entropy. So can you give us a picture to understand what's happening, I guess, in terms of disorder and complexity in the universe to kind of track it? Or what is your definition of entropy?
The definition of entropy we use is a very precise one. It goes back 130, 140 years ago to Boltzmann, who characterized what you would expect to find when you open a box that's got gas particles in. And then he can show that with overwhelming probability, they will all be more or less very uniformly distributed in the box, and the velocities will be random. They'll be whizzing around, but there will be an average speed. This was the discovery of Maxwell, actually, and it's known as the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. So what we're saying is that at the Big Bang, the universe looks like that. This certainly follows from our Newtonian model. And then if you follow the solution in either direction from the Janus point, when you get sufficiently far from the Janus point, you find that structures are forming. It gets more clustered. We can quantify this very precisely in terms of what we call the complexity. And the complexity is really the opposite of the entropy. So as the complexity grows, that means it's an improbable thing. It's like finding all the atoms in one corner of a box. But actually what you're finding, if you look around the universe, a priori, it's extremely improbable. I mean, just imagine the improbability of you and me sitting here over lunch here. It's just unbelievable. And all I'm saying is, this is the miracle of gravity. Gravity creates this. It's the ancient Greek dream of order being created out of chaos.
That's lovely. When you have this time symmetric solution and you have these kind of two mirror universes, in your solution, are they the same solution? Is exactly the same thing happening on both sides, or can they be two different universes with different fates for the particles?
Oh, absolutely. The important thing, this was nice in the Janus image that I showed, that the two sides of the Janus head are not exactly the same. They look the same, more or less, but there are features. One has got graying hair, you know, and the other. I mean, and they could be as different as me as Flavio. I mean, put us back to back. Flavio looks that way, I look this way. I'm manifestly different from Flavio. I'm about the same height, so Flavio's a bit taller than me. But nevertheless, that's the image. And this follows automatically out of the mathematics. It's absolutely there. There is an absolutely exceptional case, which you can forget about, where it's exactly the same on two sides. That's a very special case.
Barber's analysis is based on his long-running project to reformulate physics without reference to sizes and distances between objects. He and his collaborators have developed a framework that they call shape dynamics, in which the most fundamental description of particles in the universe refers to the way that shapes mapped out by particles in relation to each other change, but without reference to the absolute distances between them.
Well, very important in this is that we say that actually all you ever see is shape. You don't see overall size. When you look at the sky, you see the shape that the constellations make on the sky. You don't see how far away the stars are. So in some senses, size is invisible if you're within the system. This is a crucial part. This is why we call our theory shape dynamics.
You've got a mathematical formulation, and in that formulation, I guess when physicists usually kind of try and do calculations, they take into account the size, they talk about the universe expanding, getting bigger. But you've got a formulation where that's kind of irrelevant. Is this just a mathematical trick in terms of taking out any references to distances and scales in the mathematics, or are you saying that fundamentally there is no size in the universe?
I'm much more on the fundamental size. Now, it's very interesting when you look at both Newton and Einstein, at least at the level of the classical theory. I won't talk about quantum gravity, which does not yet exist, so we don't have to worry about that too much at this stage. When you look at the universe in its totality as a classical system, there is absolutely no meaning to its overall size. But what is very important is there is meaning to the change of its size. It is meaningful to say the universe now is twice as big as it was at some earlier epoch.
Well, Flavio, let me ask you a little bit about the analysis that you carried out. So, as I understand it from Julian's talk earlier, when you were trying to sort of look at what happens in the universe, you looked at a case of three particles in the universe. Is that correct? To kind of simplify the model. And then you're using this formulation where there's no scale involved. And can you talk about how that led to this discovery that you're now talking about, you know, this one past, two futures? How does that come out of the mathematics?
So what we did was actually to also do simulations with more than three particles, up to 1,000. There was this master's student who helped us, actually, Jerome Barclay, with whom we had some interactions at a distance. He was running simulations for us. So the three-body case is particularly useful because you can write down the equations explicitly. In this way, we could check our hypothesis on the three-body problem and explicitly prove them, and then check the 1,000-body case with simulations, and we would actually see particles going through this distinguished point, which Julian now calls a Janus surface, whatever. And then formulate an actual theorem based on mainly the work by Marshall and Sari, let's say both simulations, analytical work, and rigorous mathematical physics results were important. The
implications of shape dynamics go beyond the result on the arrow of time. If the theory is correct, it could transform the way that we think about singularities, the infinitely small and dense points thought to be at the heart of black holes and at the universe's origin at the Big Bang. At the moment, our laws of physics appear to break down at singularities, but Barber believes that this may be the wrong way of thinking about things.
Once you say that size has no meaning at all, then a lot of big issues in Einstein's theory of gravity may be completely transformed. The whole theory of singularities, whether anything serious happens at the Big Bang. You see, it was very significant when Roger Penrose was questioning me and disbelieving me. Roger said at the Big Bang, gravity is very strong and it's very important. And I said, if you take out scale, it isn't. It's exactly the opposite. Gravity ceases to play any role at the Big Bang because it's the shape of the universe is not changing significantly. This is our theory of shape dynamics, which I've been, luckily over the last 6 years or so, I've had this very good support from FQX, which has enabled me with collaborators to develop this, where we're really beginning to make progress and understanding this. So shape dynamics, it looks to us as if it will give the same observational predictions as general relativity, but a very, very different conceptual picture. So it transforms this picture that one normally has of an incredibly violent Big Bang and explosion actually into the most benign, gentle state of affairs that you could imagine.
Just to sort of clarify what's happening there. So, you know, when Roger Penrose made his comment, he's talking in the sort of the conventional view where if we have scale in the picture, we think that as we get closer and closer to the Big Bang, because everything's crushing down, it's so small, and this is the role of gravity, squashing things into this infinitely small space. And what you're saying is that if you take size out of the picture and what you're really interested in is how shape is changing, that at the time of the Big Bang, there weren't very many dramatic changes in shape. The actual interesting changes in shape are happening later in the universe.
Yes. And at the Big Bang, all that is happening is like you would, if you opened a box of gas, you would just see the particles moving around relative to each other, more or less with the same speed, and just doing, nothing interesting would happen at all. That's what the Big Bang is. It's actually the least interesting place in the universe.
Brilliant. Okay, thank you very much, Julian. Okay, Flavio, you have something to say about this comment that the Big Bang is the most boring place and time in the universe.
I just don't want the audience to get the wrong impression about this picture of the Big Bang. It's not really necessarily a peaceful event. If you believe in the validity of the embodied toy model as an example, you will see that the particles that in the late stages of the evolution form this very beautiful structure and they stick to their place. If you evolve back through this Janus point, well, all the particles will be mixed and will be scattered all over the universe. All our atoms that compose our bodies will be scattered all over the universe. So that doesn't have to be understood as a particularly peaceful or boring event. It's boring in the sense that the shape that are present at that stage are not very structured. They are not complex.
But it is truly chaos in the Greek sense. Yes. It is truly chaos.
It's the primordial chaos of the Greek cosmology or cosmogony in older terms.
There's a classical scholar for you.
Thank you.
Thank you to Julian Barber and Flavio Mercati for explaining their new work to Zia. And I guess now I know that the most boring place in the universe is the Big Bang. I always thought it was State College, Pennsylvania. Just kidding.
Okay. Yes, no offense to anyone there. On the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast, you'll find links to Barber, Kozlowski and McCarty's paper, articles about their work, and previous podcast and video interviews with Barber.